Buddhist summer school, Saturday afternoon, 2nd September 1978. The words used in the religious disciplines in the East for meditation are samadhi, or the practice of samadhi. Our English word meditation is rather an inadequate word, and actually somewhat misleading. Samadhi itself, in its whole reality, is the state of supreme communion. It is the word used to denote the actual state of supreme communion. Now, especially those who are interested in yoga should bear this very carefully in mind. This state of supreme communion is one in which, to begin with, the whole of the thinking process has been completely transcended, in which the psyche is utterly pure, in which the mind is utterly free of all concepts, ideas, beliefs, imaginative forms of any and every sort. That is why sometimes it has been called the state of nothingness, as mispronounced. It should be no-thingness. That transcendent dimension of being and consciousness, in which everything manifested, everything limited, is totally subsumed, but not annihilated at all. It is the state which supervenes with this transcending, with the subsuming, the state which supervenes, which is called the asampraññāta samādhi by the Hindus, which was called by the Buddha the cessation of all perception and feeling. Again, we are in difficulties. Perception and feeling, as we understand it, is not the only thing which ceases in that state. But the supernormal perception and feeling also has become completely quiescent and given place to this transcendent dimension. The limited is in the state of the apparatus for, to use a religious phrase, has become the holy grail for that which is beyond everything. So now, when we say meditation and imagine that we are talking of samadhi, that is not the case. Meditation in the dictionary, for example, is simply translated as musing, concentrating your thought, your attention, thinking about, spinning imaginary forms in the mind. Imaginary forms in the mind with respect to some specifically religious or ethical subject, or some proposition or profound idea, as we call it, along religious lines. That is the case, of course, when we start. You can't learn a language without starting with its alphabet and learning to spell the words and learning the meanings of simple words and joining them together to make intelligible sentences and so on and so on. Until when your genius has come to fruition, you write wonderful poetry in that language. It is like that, you see. It's that supreme state of communion where every limitation imposed by our manifested existential being and functioning have ceased to affect you. Every limitation has disappeared. You are, to use a simple word, which is a true word in this context, you are awake. Now, we must realize that since samadhi, I'm going to use the word samadhi constantly, does not emerge out of thought, but all thoughts, all ideas, all ordinary mentation, the disturbances, the superficial disturbances on the surface of the mind in its wholeness have disappeared, then the chitta vritti, as these disturbances are called, the vritti, the changing forms taken up by chitta, the mind process, that has completely calmed down, absolutely calmed down. You see? So, thought doesn't give rise to samadhi. It's the cessation of thought which allows samadhi to supervene, to be present without any obstructing influences. You will see that this is something which is utterly natural and spontaneous This state is a natural, spontaneous state for the perfected, enlightened Holy One. It is natural and constant as a living process inside him. Samadhi is something which is alive. It cannot be contrived, therefore. You cannot get materials together, mental materials together, in order to produce samadhi. All your materials have to be discarded. It's a natural living state. Do appreciate that point. It's the livingness of it which is forgotten by people who talk about samadhi. As such, it cannot be taught by anyone to anyone else. So if you want to use the word meditation in its supreme sense of samadhi, do realize that meditation in that sense cannot be taught. Can you teach your body to digest? Can you teach the blood to flow, the heart to beat? You can assist them, you can obstruct them within limits, can't you? If you obstruct them sufficiently powerfully, the body will perish. So this cannot be taught. Who teaches the body to be alive? Does anyone teach the body to be alive? It is a natural and spontaneous manifestation. We see a living body. There is this mysterious thing, the life energy, the life force, by virtue of which the body lives. The healthiest person, one day, it happens, here he is, breathing, alive, well, the last breath comes and goes out, and that body is dead. No more alive. You may teach ways of breathing if you like, but you can't stave off that extraordinary phenomenon, the last breath and the death of the body. You can't teach the body to stave off the last breath. Quite impossible. So you see, samadhi is a natural, spontaneous state which cannot be taught. What can be taught is so to penetrate into and understand the obstacles to the state of samadhi that you can grow free of them. You can't become free of them by pushing them out, or to take an analogy, by taking a dustpan and brush and sweeping the carpet clean. You can't do it that way. The obstacles constitute you. Your psychical nature are your obstacles. Hate, disturbance, anxiety, fear, greed, delusion, ignorance, all these are the obstacles. You can't throw them out like that. You can't will them out. If you fight against them, they'll become stronger in a very strange way. The demons are my children who live inside my body, not outside. I can only transform those demons. Not only have I got to transform those demons, where samadhi is concerned, where the state of supreme communion is concerned, I have to transform all the angels also who live inside my body, my being, and constitute me. Both vanish. And then there is God alone, to use theistic language, and all the archangels and angels and the demons and the devils, they all sit quietly in their proper places, playing their particular music, which makes the orchestra of the total cosmos. This is something we don't understand. Think it out, as far as it is possible to think it out. So remember that when you go to a meditation teacher, so-called, not unjustifiably so-called, when you go to a meditation teacher and so forth, you are learning a technique. You are learning something which will bring you results, but which you will have to sacrifice, get free of completely and totally, for the true samadhi to prevail. It cannot be, samadhi cannot be taught. It's a natural and a spontaneous state. And as and when that realization takes place in actual fact, then coming back to ordinary consciousness, the impress of that actual experiencing is so tremendous that once and for all you will know that all this which I have called meditation and the Unio Mystica and communion and so forth, and made wonderful imaginative thought forms about it, you see, they are all untrue to the reality. They are untrue not in the sense of being totally false. They are photographs of the living person. That photograph cannot dance with you, cannot dine with you. You can't make love to the photograph. You can only make love to the living person. You see, biologically we can experience a wonderful faint reflection of that process of union, the active expression of the unity of the universe. But in no other way do we, in our mortal state, express that. So do realize this with respect to meditation. These people who talk about transcendental meditation, or this meditation, or the Zen meditation or the Tibetan or the Theravadin or the Christian or Zarathustrian or any other meditation. These are all just names. Where you take to it in order to produce a result for yourself. Look deeply into your heart, your emotions, your feelings, your self-feeling and your self-conception. And you will find that you do all these things for the sake of self, for the sake of preserving, aggrandizing, comforting, making the separate self a magnificent specimen. That is all. Have no illusions about it. Here be ruthless with yourself. The ruthlessness which is the supreme compassion towards yourself, which alone brings about perfect purification. And when you see that all these things are done to bring about a result, you are trying to escape from dukkha instead of bringing about release from the limitations imposed by the presence of dukkha. You see, where the psyche is concerned, freedom does not lie in breaking down the prison walls and running away, making good your escape. The prison walls and so on are your whole psyche. You can't break it up. But if you do the needful, the right thing, within the psyche itself, then the prison walls disappear and you live in the garden of nature itself, and you worship in that cathedral not made by hands. And that is the state of samadhi, that meditative state, natural, spontaneous, unteachable. It comes into being through the grace of the totality, of the unborn, the unbecome, the unmade, plus the grace of the entire becoming process. Here is a question asked in connection with the precept not to kill living creatures. Insects, rodents, and other creatures that spread disease, and so on. Does this mean that we should not destroy these with insecticides, etc.? There are other situations too. If you walk on the earth, you are bound to trample upon invisible creatures. You are bound to take life. When you breathe, you will breathe in a good many creatures. tiny little fellows who got caught, and so on. Now, in one of the long discourses, the Buddha uses the word willfully, knowingly take life. What happens unavoidably by virtue of one's actually being alive in the world, nothing can be done about that. That is bound to happen in the very living process itself. We are taught, therefore, to refrain from harming. I'm putting it in its broadest form. Killing is one of the most dramatic forms of harming a creature. We are taught to refrain from all harming. Panatipata veramani sikapadam samariyami. I undertake the training to refrain from harming any creature. If one really pays attention to that, that should prevent a person from administering 30 strokes or whatever it is. The Buddha himself says, in expanding that teaching, this comes in the Brahmajala Sutta, which also is in the Digha Nikaya, the long discourses. Ashamed of roughness, the Tathagata has put aside the cudgel and the sword. If the Buddha himself has done that, who am I to use the cudgel and the sword? So the bhikkhu's training consists in being mindful, constantly mindful as possible, so that harmlessness becomes the natural and spontaneous manifestation of all his activities. And not only in terms of bodily action, but in terms of speech as well as thought and feeling. And it's a very interesting point that all the great religions have mentioned this in the ethical precepts. In thought, word, and deed, be harmless. You'll find it specially mentioned in the Yoga Upanishads. You will find it constantly mentioned in the Zarathustrian teachings, in the Buddhist teachings, and so on, and in the Christian teachings. It's in the Sermon on the Mount, isn't it? In Christianity. You have been taught, says Jesus, not to take life, but I say unto you that he who calls his brother Raka, or calls him a fool, or whatever it is, you see, hath done harm. What is the consequence of such a training, of such mindfulness? your whole psychical being becomes irradiated with considerateness for everyone around, for everything around. Loving kindness, metta, compassion, karuna, naturally grow within one. And therefore, the whole psyche becomes a source of radiation of that which enlivens, gives life, maintains, sustains life. You know, there are some remarkable accounts. There are similar such accounts throughout the religions of the world. Accounts about the Buddha, when Devadatta wanted to destroy him, he used various means. It's a long story, I'll leave out all the details, but the central point of the story is that when the Buddha came walking along the street, an elephant who was made very fierce by having intoxicating liquor given to him came from the opposite side of the street, further down from the street towards him, harming everybody in his way. And the Buddha stops and says to the elephant, "You are not supposed to do that. Here I am. You are supposed to come against me." And he filled that elephant with the radiation of complete loving kindness and compassion out of his own utterly pure being. And the elephant knelt down. It's a lovely story. He knelt down and he actually took pansil, uttered the five precepts. What an intelligent elephant. But this is, you know, just one of these lovely little allegorical stories. But we have a lot to learn out of that. You know how it is. In the presence of a person who is truly full of loving kindness, harmlessness within him, he just naturally radiates that harmlessness, and others around him respond to it. They like him. They easily become friends with him, and so forth. In the presence of a person who is a very disturbing influence, of a vicious, hateful nature, always quarreling and so forth, what happens? One feels uncomfortable, to say the least. One says, "Oh, I don't like that man. He seems an awful fellow." You see? So now, if there is this cultivation of harmlessness, that is to say, a cultivation not through taking a seed called harmlessness and planting it and making a harmlessness tree grow, but by being mindful of all that emanates out of oneself, which is of the nature of anger, of annoyance, of impatience, of hate, of revenge, of jealousy, of envy, of ambition, of competition, and so forth. Then that person is the world's true lover, and all the world loves him without understanding why. And that is the natural and beautiful thing. The mystery remains virgin, unsullied, pure. So perhaps we must bear in mind that if we are concerned, seriously concerned with the living of the religious life, that is what we have to pay attention to. But you will say that doesn't answer the question. I'm a farmer. I've got to produce so much in my orchard or whatever it is, and grow the stuff, and I must get rid of the things that destroy the apples and lemons and all the rest of it. Yes, of course you have to. I am a doctor or a hospital worker or whatever it is. Of course I have to use medicines and antiseptics and so on, which will destroy the disease-bearing germ and so on. This comes within the sphere of the life of the man of the world. We can't avoid it. If I have trained myself as a doctor, or if I'm a farmer, I have to do these things. Then it becomes a problem of balancing things. You can't stop doing what you are doing, because you have actually taken on those responsibilities. You can't throw them off your shoulders, because the unfinished karma will catch you out somewhere someday with compound interest added. So remain in that state of responsibility, doing your duties to the best of your ability, and cultivating this harmlessness within you. And you will find, perhaps, that in course of time, the circumstance, having worked itself out fully in time and space, will so change that the opportunity to be able to be utterly free of having to do this kind of thing will be yours. Don't run away from it to a monastery or a whatever it is. That is the wrong way. You see, activity which is harmful and so forth, so on, which is my lot to perform, has been due, partly at least, to me myself. Any sort of karma, any sort of action, is not your sole responsibility. This is the great mistake people make when trying to expound karma. There are always others. There are always various circumstances. There are always the influences from the past, the influences prevailing in your own environment, and so forth, and all that, some of the influences of the future towards which you particularly and those with you, associated with you, are moving. All these play their part in order to make me do this, that, and the other action, or think or feel this, that, or the other thought or feeling. There is no such thing as a totally individual karma and an individual consequence. It's not like a pound of apples delivered to you for, I don't know the price nowadays, but in the old days it was 4 pence, the old penny. It's not like that. Not at all like that. That is a childish and a hopelessly unintelligent way of approaching karma. So, I hope that these remarks will help with some sort of understanding in this matter. Here is quite an important and valuable question. It's in connection with dreams. Dreams in some detail, which, as we say, come true in terms of events the next day or week or month or whatever it is. You see? And so, the question is everything lived twice, or are some things lived twice? Now, we must realize that our living process, our whole living process, has various aspects to it. Very broadly, there is what we commonly call the physical, concrete aspect. There is the psychological aspect. And the psychological aspect, in Buddhist terms, is split into several parts. You see? The Vedana, Sanya, Sankhara, and so forth. Now, this dream is later on actually fulfilled in physical action. But in Buddhist philosophy, the physical is not separated from the psychical. It is part of the whole consciousness process. The consciousness process in the mental states, in the sleeping, the subconscious states as we call them, finds subsequent manifestation in what we commonly call the physical state. But the physical state is also a state of consciousness. And it is the consciousness on which the whole emphasis is laid in Buddhist teaching. You will also find that in dreams, things are worked out which were not worked out previously in the waking state. We have the word jagrat for the waking state, swapna for the sleeping state, dream state, and sushupti for the dreamless slumber state. The I consciousness works through the self consciousness works through all these. And you will notice that the important central point in them all is that they are all round the word I. I dreamt this. Have you ever had a dream in which the I consciousness wasn't strongly present? So you see, this I-centered, self-centered consciousness is concerned with both states, the dream state and then the action state, physical action state. So the thing is not worked out twice. It is worked out. It is apparently twice because of the phenomenon of the body going to sleep and being asleep when the vigilance center somewhere there has got too tired and can't keep awake, the body can't keep awake anymore, and also when the vigilance center is vigilant and the body is awake. It's all part of a single process. So you don't leave, as far as I can see, one doesn't live twice through it. One important point to remember is that the entire consciousness process throughout the whole psychophysical being, the body, the rupa, as well as the mental aspects, the psychical aspects, the vedana, sanya, sankhara, and vijnana itself, you see, they are all an imagination structure, including the body. They are all imagination, imaginative. When one awakes to the supreme reality, the state of the complete communion, then all these imaginative states disappear. Then there are no daydreams, no fantasies whilst you are awake, no dreams when you are asleep.